Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today's guest is Jay Hine, a distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion and also director of the Isoko Institute, an African think tank aimed at enterprise solutions to poverty. Along with former Indiana Senator Dan Coats, Mr. Hine is the co-founder and now current president of the Sagamore Institute for Policy Research, an international public policy research firm headquartered in Indianapolis, Indiana. Back in 2006 through 2008, Jay worked as the deputy assistant to the president and director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. Even earlier in his career, Hine was a welfare reform policy advisor to Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson and director of civil society programs at the Hudson Institute. Jay received a Bachelor's of Arts degree from Eureka College and an honorary Doctorate of Laws from Indiana Wesleyan University. Most recently, he authored The Quiet Revolution, An Act of Faith That Transforms Lives and Communities, which will be the focus of our discussion today. He is also editor of the New Wisconsin Idea, Reinventing Public Compassion for the 21st Century, and serves as editor-in-chief of American Outlook, a public policy journal. Last but not least, Jay was also one of the first handfuls of guests that we had on this program back in 2010, so we figured it was time to give him a call once again to see what he was up to. His earlier interview, a number of his writings, and all of those wonderful institutes he runs will be linked on our website, and so I encourage you to stop by and browse them. Jay, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Tony, thank you very much for having me.
So I'm reading your new book, The Quiet Revolution, which addresses the impact of private charity, the relationship between government and private faith-based organizations, and most importantly, the process by which this government and private enterprise thing all happens there. But I also note that the book is written in a narrative style that puts your experiences in as part of the story. So this is a really nice blend of social science-y stuff and also autobiography, making it a really, really enjoyable read. So congratulations on that book there.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you. Indeed, I was hoping that the book would be a good read where we could plumb the depths of history, social sciences, as you note, and a bit of personal narrative. But more than anything else, I hoped it would be an idea memoir. We'll get into some White House conversation. I didn't want it to be a book about President Bush principally, or, of course, not myself, but rather the real heroes that have acted by inspiration from their faith to serve the last, least, and the lost. This is a grand narrative, and so an idea memoir was the target I was shooting at.
I like that term, idea memoir, and as I mentioned before, it has some social science-y stuff in there, but also recounts a lot of your experiences that has in here. And I just popped into my mind that this is really a book of wisdom. There's social science books where we take knowledge and we run regressions and we test hypotheses and all that social science-y stuff. And that produces knowledge. But this book also has a bit of wisdom in it that, okay, here we've tried this, we've had our hypotheses, we tried these things, but here's the experience that we come out on the other side with. And then it's a reflection on all of that through your past experience. And those are really neat books. As I get older, I appreciate those a lot more.
I really appreciate that. That was aspiration for sure, and it was sort of a, what I observed at the revolution, type book because I'm trying to interpret, of course, what I've learned from great scholars, what I've learned from the great heroes who are putting these ideas to work on the front line. So trying to tell their story faithfully.
Well, it worked out very well, and so I recommend folks check out The Quiet Revolution. There is one point in the book that was stunning, though, because you recount what might be perhaps the most difficult choice that anyone has ever had to make within the walls of the White House. And that occurred in the spring of 2007. Do you remember what that was?
Yes, I think I know where you're going.
And what was it?
So the Indianapolis Colts happens to be the NFL franchise in the town with which I live, had won the Super Bowl. And as is customary, the president hosts major championship teams. And so I received one of these coveted invitations to attend a South Lawn ceremony at the White House for the Indianapolis Colts. So, you know, not only am I a fan of the Colts, but I happen to be good friends with the coach of the team, Tony Tungy, at that time. He and I were involved in many of the subjects of this book, actually, prisoner reentry and other efforts to fuel faith and service. And so it was a great privilege, of course, to walk alongside him, and I was looking forward to celebrating him at the White House after their big victory in the Super Bowl. However, as I think we'll probably touch on throughout the program, one of the lead strategies of my time in the White House was to serve governors, to move the political narrative of the faith-based initiative away from sort of Washington contentious debate and congressional sort of legislative action to the governors and to those who are local, mayors and others on the front lines. And so governors were a key part of the strategy. So just after the White House event was announced for the Colts, I received an invitation to keynote a service conference in Anchorage, Alaska, for this obscure governor nobody had ever heard about named Sarah Palin. And I thought, oh, it would be so easy for me to contact Anchorage and say, so sorry, have this previous commitment at the White House, and I'm sure actually they would have accepted that just fine. But I had a crisis of conscience, and I thought, no, you know, I'm really committed to serving governors, and my place is in Anchorage, not in the front row of this amazing ceremony. And so I am quite pleased to share with you, Tony, that I was a person of character in that decision, and I did my job. And that leads us to another very interesting part of the story about what it was like to work with such cultural personalities as Sarah Palin and Arnold Schwarzenegger and other governors who, in a very bipartisan and bullish fashion, actually, really moved the faith-based initiative forward. But I'm sure you're going to be proud of my testament of sort of willpower to stick with my day job.
Now, folks, that is commitment to the faith-based initiative. You could be there with the Super Bowl champions, Tony Dungy, Peyton Manning on that team, Reggie Wayne, but instead you chose to go possibly to the farthest place in the United States with civilization still away from Washington, D.C., and it was Anchorage. So that is truly commitment to all of this faith-based initiative program. I have to give you a little bit inside story, though, because I heard that Peyton Manning was so upset that you were not there that he promised to win another Super Bowl for you so that you could come out. And then you know what happened?
I think I know where this is going, too.
Yeah, the Seattle Seahawks happened. Yeah, yeah. It just clobbered him. So sorry about that. Maybe someday you'll be able to go and see some Super Bowl winners there. But I think you might have to do something with Seattle in order to do that, because I think we're going to win them for the next 10 years. Anyways, this does bring us up to the autobiographical part of your book, as well as your experience in the White House. And I've always been fascinated by how you get a job in the White House. I mean, you're a kid who grew up in small town Wisconsin, and then all of a sudden you're working next to the most powerful people in the United States. So you must have got through this process by also working with Governor Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin and a few other places. But how does a small town Wisconsin kid end up in the White House?
Well, this is the Research on Religion podcast, and I'm going to actually address that first as a person of faith, because there was, I think, an element of providence to this work, not to state any self-importance, actually the opposite. You know, the first response would be that I didn't try to work in the White House. This was not a career trajectory that was sort of charted out, or that was even really a big dream. It was quite a missional narrative, and indeed it does start in Wisconsin. As a young policy guy a couple decades ago, in my native Wisconsin, I think we share Wisconsin roots, I was privileged to work for Tommy Thompson, as you mentioned, who at that time, early 1990s, was answering the question that Bill Clinton posed in the 1992 campaign about ending welfare as we know it. Thompson's a competitive guy. He had been involved in a number of efforts to reconsider the 60-year entitlement welfare program at that point that was universally acknowledged as unhelpful to the poor. Governments, old welfare schemes were really showing its age, and so many unintended consequences of the system were creating disincentives to marriage and work and other habits that would create self-sufficiency. While there was wide consensus on what was wrong, there was almost no consensus on what should take its place. Thompson signed in Wisconsin legislation abolishing AFDC and tasking his administration with replacing AFDC with a program favoring personal empowerment rather than welfare entitlement. Sounds almost, sort of commonplace today because, of course, we had a federal law in 1996 which rewrote the nation's welfare program sort of statutes in the spirit of that. 1992, it was very bold. So as a part of this journey of reconsidering public assistance and its sort of fundamental form, within 4 or 5 years of the work that I was able to do with Governor Thompson and others in Wisconsin, we moved the welfare caseload from 97,000 heads of household to 7,000 heads of household, while the arrows of poverty pointed down and the arrows of employment attachment pointed up. I thought it was, sort of keeping with your football metaphor, a time to maybe celebrate in the end zone a bit. And I realized, though, as grand of a social policy success as that was, we were not fundamentally changing the nature of poverty in America. And that led to my discovery of those who were doing something about fundamental nature and hopeful solutions toward poverty in America. And these were faith-based and community organizations operating in the sort of shadows of society and in the place of greatest human need. And so I sort of shifted gears from answering the question, if there wasn't welfare, what would take its place in a sort of public context, to a think tank platform where I was able to ask a bigger question, which is, whose responsibility is to care for the poor, and how can we advance effective compassion? And that then brings me the answer to your question, because I had worked from mid-1990s to for a decade or so on the social science side of that question, the public policy side of that question, and worked with governors Bush, both in Texas and Florida, and other innovators, Dan Coates, who is a co-founder of Sagamore Institute with me, who was a leader in Capitol Hill on these questions. And so it was really in a policy context that I was invited in 2006 to lead the faith-based initiatives for the last 2 years of the Bush administration.
So that was your work at the Hudson Institute. You were doing the public policy work, right? How did you get connected with that? And what was that a main focus of the Hudson Institute at the time? Or was this something that you were championing and say, hey, you folks got to pay attention to these folks in the shadows known as faith-based organizations?
Right. So I was working alongside Hudson Institute in Madison, actually. Hudson located in a field office on Wisconsin's Capitol Square to help us with the welfare reform effort. And I greatly admired a think tank that was about first principles. 100% of the people we had on welfare were capable of meaningful activity. Social science research on the back of the day, by the way, would tell you the conventional wisdom was a case of three-thirds. One-third of welfare caseloads were gaming the system. You change the rules, they'll find productive behavior. One-third were severely sort of challenged. Maybe you could help them, maybe you can't. A third, you'll never be able to help into productive employment or contributions to society. We rejected that conventional wisdom, and Hudson was a part of helping us think through the labor market economics of that question. So they were thinking with us about first principles, about sort of the nitty-gritty, sleeves rolled up of what it takes to pass the legislation and to change the culture of the local welfare offices sort of administering these programs. And I thought, a think tank willing to be about big ideas and practical local action is, be a fun place to work. So I was privileged to be invited to join their platform, they didn't invite me to answer the question that I had posed earlier about civil society and grassroots faith-based charities. Steve Goldsmith was mayor of Indianapolis and a pioneering thinker on many of these questions. Hudson was headquartered in Indianapolis. The Bradley Foundation was a very generous philanthropic sponsor of these pursuits. But Hudson was really interested in me helping other states mirror the Wisconsin model. And indeed, I ended up working as much in the UK and Israel and Germany and Netherlands on those questions because they ran the numbers and realized they can afford their welfare states moving into the next several decades. And once they saw that America's reforms weren't cruel, just sort of punishing the poor, but were actually empowering and uplifting to the poor, they wanted to follow suit. It's just that I graduated that question, how to reinvent public assistance, to the bigger question of multi-sector reform, because employers hiring entry-level workers were as much a part of the equation as the faith-based charities helping the addict recover.
And so with the Hudson Institute, you started working with other governors that you mentioned. One of them was George W. Bush down in Texas. So you knew him before he was president. Was that your inroads to the White House, or were you just walking around D.C. one time and you saw a notice up on a phone pole that says, would you like to work in the White House? Call 555-1515 or something.
That's right. That's right. I didn't get that memo. No.
Okay.
It takes us back to the idea of memoir point. So Steve Goldsmith, as I mentioned, was in Indianapolis, mid-90s, very innovative mayor. And he launched one of the first faith-based initiatives in the modern context. So let me segue from welfare reform to the faith-based initiative at this point. You may know that Senator Ashcroft included in the welfare reform law of 1996 a provision called charitable choice. And that was a public policy acknowledgement that government wasn't going to execute compassion in a way that restored lives. Government could set the rules to incentivize productive behavior, and that was an accomplishment of welfare reform. And it set the, you know, sort of cultural change and the right signals as well. But it, you know, its rules favored, you know, health and development rather than the unintended consequences of the 70s and 80s and the LBJ Great Society programs that turned unhelpful to the poor. The welfare law under Ashcroft's charitable choice provision acknowledged that the hard work, the more harder to serve cases, were really going to need to rely on the efforts of, you know, transformation, personal transformation, not government transaction. And the leaders of the personal transformation business were those frontline faith-based charities. So charitable choice was acknowledgement of the key constitutional precept, the delicate balance of protecting religious expression while stopping short of establishing state-sponsored religion. And so it was a very helpful late 90s correction to so much jurisprudence previously that had shrunk the reach of faith-based social service in America. If you were St. Mary's of the Woods, you were oftentimes stopped at the front door because of your name as government's partner. We can get into a philosophical and even a practical conversation about whether faith-based organizations should partner with government. But for those that sought to do so as a part of their service delivery, we felt it was unfair for them to be discriminated against because of the character of the organizations being faith-based. So there was some discrimination to end. And indeed, I worked a bit through Hudson with Governor Bush in Texas about ending such discrimination. But Steve Goldsmith went past that as mayor. Rather than setting up a program in City Hall that would award grants to faith-based organizations, he took another approach that he referred to as a civic switchboard. And so his idea was, as mayor, he should be listening to these organizations to find out what's going on in the tough parts of Indianapolis's neighborhoods, to the solutions that these innovators were coming up with, and then to think about how government could get out of the way or pave the way for them to be more successful. So it was very much a spirit of partnership side by side rather than top down.
Mm-hmm. And then so you get connected with the faith-based initiative in the White House. Now, you weren't there at the initial beginnings of it. You were near the end of the Bush administration, 2007, 2008. That's correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So Hudson remained a partner with the new White House office. So the faith-based initiative took form in the in the context of the first policy speech of the campaign, which, by the way, was in Indianapolis, sponsored by Steve Goldsmith. So it's called Duty of Hope. I commend it to all the listeners today to read. I think it's one of the more special public policy speeches on effective compassion in sort of the modern era. It's a remarkable speech, and it's called Duty of Hope, July 1999, delivered by candidate Governor George Bush in Indianapolis to launch his campaign. When we see public need, human need, we'll declare it unacceptable. We'll look not to government, but to the faith-based and community organizations who are in the best position to meet those needs, and flows from there. It's a really remarkable speech. So it was testament to the inspiration of the Indianapolis model, and a signal of how the Bush administration had intended to operate. Of course, we know that the administration changed, 9 months in because of 9/11, but the White House that was envisioned was, of course, I kind of hesitate to use the political term of compassionate conservatism. It's a bit maligned in its sort of image these days. But the idea was taking conservative principles, human scale, local, the human freedom, and declaring sort of the compassion side of not laissez-faire, but saying when a neighbor is in need, and in a great Tocquevillian sort of spirit that has always defined the American idea, life on life, citizen on citizen, we're going to engage. And as a society, we'll solve these problems, not as the state. So this was the idea. And so week one of the Bush administration, the executive order was signed establishing the White House Office of Faith-Based Community Initiatives, which was a White House team supporting the president's personal leadership of this issue, but also a cabinet-level set of teams that over the course of the administration grew to 12 federal agencies so that these questions could be considered across the Bush administration. And so our team at Hudson provided external counsel to the team inside government. So we were active from the outside looking in. And then, as we've already referenced, later on I was actually invited to help lead the last 2 years, which needed to consider redirection within the administration, but also consideration of what should happen after the Bush administration. So it was an interesting time to serve.
Now, we talked about the faith-based initiative more extensively back in our 2010 podcast, and we'll refer people back to that as well as to the speech by President Bush, The Duty of Hope, so you can check those on our website. But just briefly, give us a encapsulation of what the faith-based initiative was. Some of its basic origins, I know some of this goes back to President Bush's father, runs through the Clinton administration. And then also give us an idea of what the different component parts of this faith-based initiative was.
Sure. So as I mentioned, it was established by executive order. So this was something the president was able to act on. His personal leadership, and so it became a very personal, sort of element of his time. Just as an aside, one of the parts of the job I found fascinating working inside the White House was the market share competition. I think to the casual observer of the presidency, we think it's all about the president. It's what he wants to do. It's what he says. It's the course he sets. But the modern institution of the White House is really properly known as the Executive Office of the Presidency, is large and complex. And so you can imagine, there's a lot of different viewpoints. What you can't really appreciate until you see it from the inside out is how much power staff has to set message and policy direction. President can't do it all. So he needs to sort of set his principles in place and build his team, but there's a lot of decentralization actually within the administration. Against that backdrop, that there's a lot of forces, the economic team, the security team, different policy interests, all sort of competing for market share. What does market share mean in government? It means the president's time. Is he going to give a speech on your issue or somebody else's issue? It's legislation, it's spending, it's policy decision making. And so it's just an important starting point before we get into the particulars of the initiative to acknowledge that this is something the president spent a lot of his time on in the campaign and then for 8 years. And so he gave dozens of speeches. You know, so when you make the effort of taking Air Force One out of Washington to go to St. Louis, you know, typically it's the convention center and the economic speech. The fact that he would go to St. Louis to go to an inner-city ministry serving homeless vets, and he would drape his arm, you know, around the priest that might be running that program and say, Father, when you serve your neighbor in need, you're serving your nation, and I'm here to say thanks. I think this is the signature accomplishment of the faith-based initiative, again, before we get into the particulars on the programmatic side, because culture changed during those 8 years. In the 1990s, Stephen Carter, you know, center-left Yale professor from Yale, writes a book called The Culture of Disbelief, which is premise rests on the idea that religion is the only acceptable prejudice in America. And that typified, you know, culture that we were living in mid-1990s. Now, faith-based is part of the vernacular, and it's presumed positive. I had countless inner-city ministries say to me, please thank the president on my behalf. Before this initiative, I was either invisible or deemed suspect at the table in the public square. Now, I'm a first call, you know. Mm-hmm. Pastor, we have gang violence. Pastor, we have addiction problems. You know, what can you do to help? And so that culture change, this is a conservative notion, I think, of governing, is that it wasn't legislated, it wasn't a spending issue, but rather it was an effective use of the bully pulpit. But it took the president caring about the issue, using some of his, you know, market share to spend time on the issue. I think that's the most important first point, and then I could give you just a very brief sort of factual 30-second framing of the organization of the Faith-Based Initiative, which was...
Okay, well, hang on, let me stop you there a minute, and I want you to give that framing, but that is one thing that I do want to highlight about your book, The Quiet Revolution, was these personal anecdotes that are peppered throughout the book about President Bush, as you say, putting his arm around some pastor in you know, downtown St. Louis. That stuff that really never made the news that much.
And you didn't read that in the Washington Post, really?
Surprisingly, no. But it's really fascinating. It gave me a little glimpse into the White House as well, because you know, we saw that on 9/11 when President Bush put his arms around the fireman that was standing on top of the rubble and things like that. So we got that image. But this was a modus operandi of Bush. He wasn't somebody sitting there in the Oval Office saying, let's get the local communities engaged. But he actually moved outside of that presidential bubble to talk with people in the grassroots, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And it was authentic. I mean, it really mattered to him. He understood it. You know, again, sort of, you know, putting this a bit in a spiritual context, the president had a conversion experience. He was leading a pretty tough life. You know, I visited with him he and I went to a prisoner reentry program in Baltimore. And, you know, 12, 15 guys that just got out of prison. And it was one of the faith-based initiatives where we were attaching mentors to these guys who wanted to be healthier when they got back out. So he sits across the table from them, and they're pretty intimidated to, you know, meet the leader of the free world. And he said, you know, we're actually more alike than you realize, than you may realize. He said, I drank too much, but I met the Lord. He said, you heard about the 12-step program? He said, I had a Texas two-step. You know, I found the Lord, and I quit drinking.
Yeah.
And so he knew the power of personal faith and personal conversion. He also understood the constitutional parameters of what's effective and possible, you know, in government. So he oftentimes said, whether you're of this faith, that faith, or no faith at all, you're equally American, of course. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he understood it on a personal level, and he understood, you know, who did execute change in the most profound way. I mean, it's the former addict that's helping the current guy struggling and is willing to take the call at 10 o'clock on Saturday night when addiction is flaring and the pressure is high, or he gets his first paycheck. You know, not come meet me Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock and we'll talk. Not to disparage traditional social service, there's a place for that. But he understood that the heart of the faith-based initiative was personal, and it meant a lot to him. And so he did engage at that level, not only that he gave his time to this, but he was fully present in these meetings. You know, back to the Baltimore scene, and I'll just lay this out for, you know, 30 seconds, but it typifies it rather than giving you a number of examples. This really captures it. So we meet this one gentleman recently released who says, you know, Mr. President, this is the best day of my life and the worst day of my life. This, you know, I get to meet the President of the United States, but I'm talking about the thing I'm most embarrassed about, you know, my past, you know, as a criminal, as someone who broke the law. And he said, and, you know, I'm trying to live better now, and I want my daughter to see me as a healthy person, not as somebody that struggled the way that I have in the past. And so the President, that gentleman happened to be the one that the White House speech writing team had identified to be our success story when the President gave a little readout from his visit to the White House press traveling with him. And so he's going through his note cards, speaking to the press, and he's about to get to this guy's story. And I could see his eyes avert from the note card, and I could just imagine what he was thinking, the father of two daughters himself. He's thinking, this guy's daughter's watching this, and I'm about to tell all the nasty stuff he did, because that's the only way you can appreciate how much he's progressing. But by rehearsing all those past sins and crimes, this daughter's going to hear the President of the United States say some pretty ugly things about her dad. So he disregarded that part of his speech, and he said instead, you know, just like I was telling the guys back there, you know, I used to drink too much. You know, so my eyes immediately turned to the White House press corps, and I'm watching them scribble notes, and I thought, there's the headline, you know, of this visit. And sure enough, coast to coast, there was Bush recalls drinking past stories. And I thought, you know, I really am proud, you know, to work for a president that's willing to trade a day's news cycle to invest in a life, which he did. And, you know, so that typifies, I think, the heart the president brought to this initiative and the culture change that was a part of it. You know, let me quickly acknowledge, though, too, that, you know, it's there are mistakes we made, and that, you know, the president, you know, could have moved in policy different ways. And this isn't a universal sort of, you know, story of success. And I, you know, want our listeners to think that, you know, this isn't just about, you know, the president did it all right and we did it all right. There's, you know, there's real limits to what we were able to do in the White House, and it's very fair. People could debate, you know, different policy direction. But one thing that was indisputable is his heart. And his philosophy of the initiative was very, very impressive, and to the point you were referencing, sorely underreported.
So go ahead and tell us what the faith-based initiative was. As I understand it, there were basically three component parts to this faith-based initiative, and then I want to turn to how this does get implemented in the grassroots, not only President Bush going out there and meeting with prisoners, but you did a lot of stuff with the states. But let's start at the federal level and explain what this faith-based and community initiative was.
Yeah. So the executive order established the White House office. So that was the director of the initiative who served the president personally as part of the White House senior staff. And then there were cabinet agencies, so centers for faith-based and community initiatives at, you know, Labor and USAID and across the federal government. And each of these offices were doing a few things at once. There was the thought leadership, you know, so this is a way of signaling to society using our, you know, sort of convening power of the federal government and the White House, to say that these faith-based partners and community partners were consequential, and celebrating their reach and their effectiveness. So there's a thought leadership component. Then there was a leveling the playing field component. So this was a very rigorous review inside federal law to identify those places all across federal government grant making where there was an overreach by government to discriminate against the character of faith-based organizations. And again, leveling the playing field, not showing any favoritism, but just saying they should have a fair fight if they're going after public dollars to serve the homeless or other public goods. And then, and third, there was demonstration. What did it look like to, you know, put this stuff in motion? And so we had an access to recovery, you know, program for substance abuse, which was remarkable. You know, rather than having the government pick two or three vendors in your community in Washington, so that if you're struggling, you'd be able to go to a couple places the government picked. We created a voucher program so that you could identify whether you wanted a big traditional program or a very grassrootsy faith-based based program and you know, be a part of your own pathway to recovery. So opened up the marketplace of providers. They certainly had to meet certain health and safety standards, but otherwise we were empowering the individual and empowering the marketplace, enlivening the marketplace, and it had a great effect. Prisoner reentry, you know, mentoring children prisoners, there's way too many of them. They're 7 times more likely to pursue a life of crime. In 5 years, we recruited 100,000 mentors for children prisoners, mostly African-American men from churches, non-paid. I mean, they're true volunteers. And it took Big Brothers Big Sisters 100 years to get 100,000 mentor matches of any kind. In 5 years, we got that same number, 100,000, just for children prisoners. So there was a demonstration where the president in a State of the Union would announce this kind of action, you know, the access to recovery or prisoner reentry programs. And then we would work inside government and with our local partners to execute those programs and to demonstrate the way through smaller grants, mini grants, which opens up, you know, the partnerships to the smaller groups, or through, you know, these innovations like vouchers, or, you know, interrupting the cycle of crime with mentors, putting some big ideas to work was part of the demonstration side. So a lot of individual moving parts, but that's the essence. Those three parts were the essence of the initiative.
Now, a lot of the focus on the faith-based and community initiative, and John DeLulio was part and parcel of this, and he was instrumental in being in Washington, D.C. quite a bit, helping to set this up. The focus was on the federal government, and a lot of the story that we even still tell today on the academic side is focusing on what the federal government was doing to promote this. And your book, The Quiet Revolution, actually changes the focus of this a little bit. It wasn't just a federal program, but it was a federal program designed to really empower and to partner with groups at the grassroots level. Tell us more about that and your role in working with the different states and missing out on the Indianapolis Colts being there on the East Lawn.
That's right. So it was an intentional shift, and it probably goes back to the question of why I was asked to serve at the end of the administration. It's very appropriate, you know, to have an academic in John DeLulio, happens to be a Democrat, reflecting the bipartisan nature of these questions, how government could more effectively partner with faith-based and community groups, but also one who understood the federal government, and he was written in public administration, student of the process. And if leveling the playing field, ending discrimination, was necessary, and it was terrific to have someone like John and his successor, Jim Toohey, who's a lawyer, and was able to take on a lot of the policy battle to level the playing field. And because they accomplished a lot with the teams that they led inside government, you could begin to see the success taking root, which was good, institutionalizing this level playing field. But then also, we were starting to see the damages done of the, you know, sort of Washington, D.C. politics surrounding the initiative. And so, you know, the conversation got marginalized to, you know, congressional debate or the politics of, you know, whose side are you on. And so we're losing the focus of why we were doing this faith-based initiative and what its full promise was, which is properly understood in communities. So I spent 2 years on two large tactics. I continued the work of my predecessors to continue to you know, perform at the federal policy level the way that we needed to. I didn't stop that. But I did want to shift the emphasis to community. That's where it started, and this is where, you know, the book widens the angle view too and shows the limits of government, because the faith-based initiative in its fullest form is not a government program. It's the nature of the church, and that makes it a 2,000-year narrative. And so the closer we get to private and local, the more we can understand the faith-based initiative in its fullest form and its most promising form. So my two sort of tactics to try and push the conversation out, and post-Bush presidency, I hope the center of gravity would leave Washington and be enlivened at the community level, was to do two things, one inside the White House and one in the state capitals. Inside the White House, we held a Compassion and Action roundtable every month, Greatest Human Needs Imaginable, 30 million modern-day slaves, human trafficking, 50% dropouts in urban America, you know, all these huge problems in society that I would feature with Mrs. Bush or a cabinet member or some big deal saying we should care of this, and in the president's word, we should, you know, declare these things unacceptable. But then to feature throughout the program the, you know, local, small, grassroots, faith-based and community healers that were actually solving those problems. And so that was a way to demonstrate, you know, what the real faith-based initiative was all about, and again, kind of use our bully pulpit function. But then to go to the governors and say, we had 19 Democratic, 16 Republican governors who established their own faith-based offices, and to help them execute, not at the state level, but even at the community level. They're the actors that can work with local communities. They're the ones that know the poor more by name, not as statistics. And so we used a lot of our energy inside the White House to help the governors, and not only those 35 governors that had their own offices, but in all 50 states. You can't do a access to recovery voucher program that I talked about from Washington, D.C. You can set the rules in Washington, D.C., but it's in Wyoming and Arizona and Florida that these programs get implemented. So we were shifting the center of gravity, and again, received very, very sort of, you know, paltry press attention, which is unfortunate because it didn't really enliven the public imagination. But it did work, and it did achieve real change.
Which is really the cool story that you tell in The Quiet Revolution, and one that really doesn't get told. I mean, even from my angle, and I'm, you know, pretty well informed about the faith-based initiative. I study religion and politics, but a lot of the attention really gets sucked up to the federal level. And I tend to get a little bit froggy when everything is being dictated from Washington, D.C., and I'm 3,000 miles away, and they don't know what my local community is doing. So the fact that the faith-based and community initiative was really oriented toward that, and that, you admit, there has to be some struggles to remind people that, yeah, we have to take this down to the grassroots, is really the cool story that you tell in The Quiet Revolution. And in that respect, I'd like you to tell us some stories. You said you worked with two dozen or so Republican governors and some Democrat governors, and so you saw different experiments, a natural experiment in many ways, occurring in the United States. Where did some of the faith-based community initiatives work in some states? Where did they have some problems? Tell us some examples of what's going on here at the grassroots and your job in promoting that.
It was a very helpful story, actually. There wasn't much on the side of the ideas not working. The question was more, you know, how much territory were they gaining? You know, how much were they accomplishing? Because, again, you know, it was not the governor's job to build too much, but rather to reorient from the state capitol to get a clear line of sight to those already in their communities who were doing heroic acts, and then, much like Steve Goldsmith's example, consider how they could be a help to them, almost in a more of a servant leader capacity rather than this sort of top-down capacity. So in that respect, it was a 50-state strategy, and it took root in remarkable ways. So I'll give you a couple quick stories. One of my favorites is the governator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who did not become one of 35. So he didn't establish a faith-based office in Sacramento. There was some skittishness around the faith side of the faith-based initiative, as I understood his team explain it. So they stopped short. But that didn't mean the faith-based initiative didn't work in California. So one of the techniques I used was a mapping process where I was able to show those faith-based and community groups that were partnering with us on prisoner reentry, access to recovery, and others. So Governor Schwarzenegger joined the other nation's governors as his annual custom in January February. They come to the White House to meet with the president. And so I and my staff, we built a state-by-state report of how the faith-based initiative was working, and I was seated with Governor Schwarzenegger at dinner, and so eager to watch him flip to California and to see his map and see his eyes widen when he saw that $1 billion a year, every year, is the number that faith-based and community groups across California win in federal grant competition. And then the icons on the map show whether it's a presidential initiative, such as prison reentry, or other things. So you take a governor who maybe before this level of understanding thinks, you know, it's good to have charities. It's nice to have charities in our state. But they don't see them as necessary problem-solving agents. And now you could call this a billion-dollar solution. This $1 billion is not in the state budget. So your Governor Schwarzenegger is thinking, these small groups, top to bottom in California, win on an annual basis $1 billion to do what? Break up gang violence, you know, heal an addict, do all the hardest problems really on his desk. So you move from this sort of sweet narrative of charities to this essential narrative of you know, human transformation and community revitalization. But if there is an over-reliance on legislation and government spending and government sort of dominance in the narrative, you miss the story. You know, so we use this map technique and some other methods to enliven the real story, you know, and mention the Tocquevillian sort of spirit when Alexis de Tocqueville visits the states, among his many other incredible observations, was this one: when tragedy befalls an American citizen, the purse strings of 1,000 strangers open up to him, which is, of course, counter his experience as a European elite who saw the state solve problems or problems not get solved. But here, you care for your neighbor, which has now become, you know, $300 billion a year in annual private giving in the states. And it's a large narrative, but it's built of these small parts. And it isn't uniform by definition. And so how do you make that muscular, you know, that narrative? Because it's muscular to talk about who got elected and how much government spends and whether the law got passed. But it's a bigger story, the self-organizing society that we live in that has a, you know, a real sort of free market dimension to philanthropy. And so we use the mapping technique in our conversation with governors to be able to be the mouthpieces, really, for it. And then to consider questions. You know, Janet Napolitano is governor of Arizona and constitutional lawyer and very different political views than President Bush, but was one of the top defenders of the constitutionality of the faith-based initiative. Bill Richardson, an adjoining state to hers, you know, these are both presidential candidates actually back then, and he had an innovation, you know, in a different sort of policy-driven way than Governor Pawlenty, another presidential candidate in Minnesota, was interested in caring for returning vets. You got Mitch Daniels in Indiana, another presidential candidate. It was a remarkable set. We had most of the presidential field from the gubernatorial standpoint that were formally attached to the initiative, and meeting on the common ground of saying government should be a better partner to these organizations. And really, the story is more about innovation, you know, and the customization of, you know, what advances the governor's priorities in a state-by-state context, which, again, you can't do that with the clumsiness and the bigness of Washington. You can do that in state capitals.
Yeah, I was fascinated by the California story because you had mentioned that in some of these other places, the governors were very open to partnering right away with faith-based organizations. They were ideologically pump primed for this in many ways. And so they set up specific offices. But as you mentioned, in California, they didn't set up a faith-based and community initiative office. And at one point in time, you might go, uh-oh, this is going to lead to disaster. But in many ways, the faith-based and community initiative, through its granting process and leveling the playing field, did an end around, so to speak, of the state government and went right to the grassroots. And the fact that you pointed this out to Schwarzenegger and he goes, oh my gosh, you know, hey, politicians love to hear $1 billion coming in to help this, that, and the other people, because next time you're up on the podium talking to your constituents, you can champion that kind of thing. Here's the question I have then. Did you find it easier, or were there differences in working with a state that did set up a specific statewide faith-based community initiative office versus one that did not?
You know, to be candid, it didn't make a huge difference.
Okay.
I think there was a moment in time when you had the White House articulating a message saying we're overlooking a big problem, a big segment of America's problem-solving solution, you know, these faith-based community groups. And so the governors, on a bipartisan emphasis, and of course I underscored the, you know, the fact that there were more Democrats and Republicans even that established these offices, was part of the speaking point, you know, to be able to say, look, this is not only bipartisan, it's really nonpartisan. And a lot of it's public administration. How do we level the playing field? More of it is civil society. How do we enliven civil society? And how do we engage this self-organizing nonprofit sector, in a way that uplifts, and leverages? Because, of course, the spontaneous order of the nonprofit community is wonderful, because it can be so individual and responsive and entrepreneurial. But there are redundancies, there are gaps, there are problems. You from City Hall and from the State House, you can help that sector, with the data that you have, the smart use of big data, with other mechanisms. So, we need to graduate into that level of sophistication. And the faith-based offices helped get that going, but they weren't going to be the full-on solution, which brings us to our shared platform at Baylor University. Mm-hmm. I gave this talk at Baylor at the end of my time in Washington and sort of cast vision for how the center of gravity needed to be elsewhere. And I somewhat provocatively said to Baylor, it should be the center of gravity should be a place like Baylor, where you have this rigorous social science, faith, sophisticated sort of perspective. And Byron Johnson, our mutual friend at Baylor, said, you're actually right. So Baylor is one of the solutions, and one of the key solutions to enlarging the narrative, to embracing the complexity of what the real faith-based initiative is, which brings in religious liberty questions continually. With the ground that we gained in the Bush administration, I'll say, has certainly had to stand shift in this administration, which is less committed to protecting religious liberty. And so the fights have to continue to keep the ground on religious liberty, while we need to realize that's not the water's edge, because religious liberty is important. It's just not the destination. The destination for the faith-based initiative to love neighbor as itself is about this community-level sort of effective compassion and enlarging our response to the needs in society. So, a place like Baylor that has the research acumen and the elite networks to move the conversation forward is a more appropriate home for the future of the faith-based initiative than in Washington.
Well, I would second that, and I think that's one thing we can agree on. Even though you like the Packers and I like the Seahawks, I say sick 'em Bears. Before we move on to the future of the faith-based initiative, one of the other things that you do in The Quiet Revolution is not only talk about how the United States helped to shift the cultural landscape and the policy landscape toward grassroots organizing and partnering with faith-based organizations, but also taking this internationally. And a important component of the Bush administration's faith-based initiative was not just in the 50 United States, but internationally. And you talk about this in Africa. Briefly tell us about the international aspect of this general idea or program.
Sure, and it was of a piece. And this speaks to the value of the, of the consequential platform, when you occupy the White House. This goes back to this notion of what President Bush intended to be the compassionate conservatism. So in 1999 to 2000, more Africans died of AIDS than Africans who had died in all the wars of that continent put together in its past. This pandemic is hard to get our minds around how enormous the human tragedy was. And, of the 25 or 30 million Africans who were infected by HIV in 2000 when Bush took office, less than 100,000 were receiving any form of life-saving drug therapy. So it was a pure death sentence. It was multiplying because the stigma attached with disease meant that people wouldn't admit that they had it, and social exclusion. It was just this compounding chaos. And the president stepped into that unilaterally and said, we're a rich enough nation that we can impose a solution, and we can create life and hope in a continent that is dying and fearful. So he moved forward on the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS relief and a large U.S. government commitment, all based on performance metrics. So they went where need was high, but the solutions were available. And the presidents were willing to, ensure good government and hit their marks where they would show progress. this required a return on investment. It's a remarkable public administration story. 87% of the grantees, though, who actually delivered this work were faith-based and community groups. These were the local village level agencies. The church is the number one sort of credible organization in Africa, way more than the government, way more than the police. And so we were investing in these very small actors with this very large solution. So successful that today, with a straight face, diplomats can talk about an AIDS-free Africa. That's how much ground has been 20, 30 years. That's how much ground has been gained. It's a remarkable story. But the local touch, the human touch of this was an overlooked part of the narrative. So I did host a conference in Africa talking about the role of these faith-based in community groups, most of whom, so maybe World Vision might get the contract from the federal government, but the contract would require a World Vision to pass through those dollars to its local network. So, as I said, 80% of the grantees ultimately became these indigenous local institutions who were serving their neighbors and who were going to be doing the work after the United States government was done with its intervention. So it was a very smart solution and an uplift to a sector by infusing dollars the right way and technology and better ways to approach problem solving. You were building capacity at the local level. So it was a remarkable part of the narrative, but it wasn't, this really distinct part of the narrative. We could talk about the role of faith-based groups either healing Africa or building the economy or educating Africa, because these groups have profound roles in such grand sort of public good pursuits. Again, why I call the book Quiet Revolution, these are often overlooked parts of the story. They're revolutionary in their historic narrative. The church has started schools and hospitals and had such consequence even in establishing the free market economy, faith-infused thinkers and doers. Truly revolutionary, but quiet in that, these are not reported stories, and they're not properly understood stories. So as provocative and grand as the African narrative was, it was actually of a piece. The same work that we were doing, in an African village or an American prison. Same principles were at the center, and the same precepts we were running on, which is the state has a role to enliven and enrich and expand civil society, not to choreograph it or to control it.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons this makes a great read. It's not only applicable here to the United States, but to everywhere. And this quiet revolution of things happening on a day-to-day basis in these small churches of a couple dozen or a few hundred folks working with people on a day-to-day basis, that's where the action is, even though we tend
it
to...
It is. Yeah. And also, Tony, just another point, addendum to the international side. If you could picture a bar chart in your head, one really big and one really small, the really small bar would be the United States government's investment in official development assistance, or what we call foreign aid, $20 billion a year, which is actually not that small, but is quite small when you consider the larger bar, which is private social investment in the developing world, which Carol Edelman is one of the top researchers in this field. At Hudson Institute, former colleague who reports $150 billion or so a year that private individuals and churches and other agents of civil society contribute to the developing world. So, as important as the $20 billion is, and we need to do foreign aid well if we're going to do foreign aid, and the performance metrics that the Bush administration used was a good sort of remedy to, some failed approaches to state-to-state foreign aid in the past, government to government. The citizen to citizen model of foreign aid, if you will, or international development, is a way bigger narrative, but again, comprised of all these small parts. As a matter of fact, remittances, agent of the developing world who cuts your grass, in the States, sent by his family maybe to earn some money here, these very modest, sort of workers in the American economy, that support their families back home, we can track these numbers because of the Western Union transfers and remittances. That's $80 to $90 billion a year. So just the small scale remittances is, four times larger than the United States government's transfer of taxpayer support to the developing world. So, you know, this is why research is important. We have to be more rigorous in understanding the nature. But we're not going to program this. This is because citizens, particularly now in a more globalized society, most often inspired by their faith, are performed this way. And so understanding these things and creating better ways to think about it and then hopefully, you know, improve behavior should be the conversation of the future.
Speaking of the future, that's the question I want to close on here. You made a very strong case of how the quiet revolution has slowly crept across the United States and major parts of the world in the past 20 or so years. What about the future? And this is a big topic, but in the next 5 minutes or so, what does this quiet revolution look like moving forward? Do you have great optimism for it, or are there looming clouds on the horizon that we need to worry about?
Let me start answering that question with a few questions, which is, you know, what role should the White House play moving forward? And what's the nature of politics in this question? What's the future of jurisprudence around these questions? What's the role of the church as the church? What's your role? That's really where I wanted to end the book, is, you know, I make a point maybe in the last paragraph that, you know, that the tools of compassion should best fit the hand of the individual. We need to consider what this means in each in our own lives and our contribution to creating a better society. And so the future rests on how we bring some answers to, you know, to those three or four or five dimensions to the conversation. The White House does have a role, or the federal government and state government does have a role, and the more they can keep the playing field level, the healthier we will be as a society, because the freer these faith-based groups will be able to be in adoption and hunger alleviation and all the other public good that we want in our individual communities. Will the courts back that up? You know, will they return to the 1960s and 70s bias against faith in the public square? Or will they, operate with the level playing field approach in their rulings? And then shifting away from policy or law, is the church going to be the church? You know, I wanted to speak to the faithful in this book to say we should celebrate this grand narrative, the church's contribution to better society. But we should also ask the question, how active is your faith? You know, are you part of this narrative? Are you contributing to the good around you, meeting needs and expanding healthy society in your sphere of influence? You know, whether it's a little league coach or as a CEO. How can we use research to continue to investigate the thorny issues around this, the big sort of unresolved questions? And so there is a great role for the university and for thought leaders to continue to stretch us. We know that the world got a lot smaller in the technology age, we know that the world is a very religious people, and we also know that those religions don't always cohabitate nicely, that there's a lot of conflict around that too. So we need to be literate. One of the chapters of the book talks about the need for us to be highly literate on world religion. It's an essential part of statecraft and diplomacy, of course. How do we talk about the future of Jerusalem if we think it's just real estate? We need to understand the religious forces. So we need to be better students, all of us. The bias of the book is to say we also need to be better actors. We need to put our faith in action in more powerful ways.
Well, that is what we try to do here on Research on Religion, make everybody better students. And your book, The Quiet Revolution, really helps to accomplish that as well. Jay, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
I'm grateful, Tony. It's always fun.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org.
if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.